pastors' sermons. These pastors participated in a petition signing to overturn what's known as a bathroom bill, having people who, as Gary points out in his article here, that, have a gender confusion somewhat, and they can use the same bathrooms. And then you have in Idaho, you have a minister who is, and his wife being attacked and even threatened with legal action because they do not want to marry same-sex couples. And in California, we have an issue. We have a lot of issues on this to go in today. So I want to bring into the program, right from the start, Gary Porter. Gary, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Bruce. Good morning, Corinne. And Sam, I guess.
Sam?
Sam and Chuck, yep.
Oh, both. Okay, great. Well, welcome to you all. Yeah, I called my essay, Houston, We Have a Problem, after the famous NASA
I like that.
saying by that of the Apollo mission. This is really an unprecedented affront. And for the city of Houston to ask pastors for their or demand from pastors their sermons is just, we've never faced that before, and it kind of shocks you that there would be even a tendency to do this. This is reaching beyond traditional boundaries in an unprecedented way. But I want to bring out another aspect of this that I didn't talk about in the essay because I hadn't really been informed of this. But we look at Houston and we see this lesbian mayor has been elected as their mayor, and I found out recently that that occurred in an election in which only 13% of the Houston electorate took part. That is, only 13% of the registered voters in Houston actually took part in that election and elected this mayor. When you add to that the statistic that only about 25% of evangelical Christians vote in any election, I think you can see why the city ended up in this situation. So that's something that really needs to be addressed by the church. The churches the pastors have to explain to their congregations just how important their vote is.
And Gary, with the midterm elections coming up next Tuesday, that's a very good point to put out there, because here in Pennsylvania as well, we're facing a challenge to the governor of Pennsylvania, and this is pretty serious as well. So, they need not to just kind of put this to the side. They need to be involved.
Well, traditionally, midterm elections don't gather a whole lot of interest, but this is an incredibly important one with the Senate riding in the balance. If people don't get out and vote this Tuesday, we could end up for the next 2 years in the same situation we are right now with the Senate blocking any sort of legislation passed by the House, and the nation's just sitting here spinning, so to speak, without being able to move forward at all. So,
well, yeah, and also we can clarify with the blockage in the Congress, it's so easy for this president and for others to say a do-nothing Congress. They come in, they don't get anything done. But when you really look at it with destruction, we talked about this with the 17th Amendment, what it created. We have a majority leader in the Senate, Harry Reid, that any bill, and bills have been passed by the House, go to the Senate, and they get stacked and die on his desk. So it's literally one person, Harry Reid, the obstructionist, that is causing the problem in Congress, one of the major reasons why they only have a 13% approval rate.
Right, and that just gives the president then further ammunition to go outside the bounds of the traditional executive powers and act like a king.
Yeah.
Because, he claims that Congress isn't getting anything done, so he has to. So we've got to free this logjam in the Senate by voting in some Republicans that will change the balance there and allow the legislation that's been piled up to actually make its way to the president's desk.
Right. Now, looking at what you wrote in here about Houston, that they were looking at getting people to sign basically a petition to have a referendum put on to have their quote-unquote bathroom law overturned, or actually it's an ordinance, overturned, and that the petitions contained 50,000 votes, and after the city clerk did their duty of verifying, it came to 30,000, but they only needed 17,269 required, in which they come out, the city's attorney comes out, the whole thing became politicized, lied, and said they were 2,000 votes short.
Yeah, I just, I can't fathom how you can take 50,000 votes on referendums and say that only 17,000 of those, actually only 15,000 of those were valid. I mean, that just doesn't pass the giggle test. And so there's something else going on down there.
Right.
I want to take a moment and say good morning to our listeners now tuning in on their radio dials to 1180 AM WFYL. We're licensed in King of Prussia, Philadelphia. You're listening to We the People, Constitution Matters. I encourage you to call in 877-667-1180 or 610-539-TALK. You can email us, info@1180wfyl.com, and you can listen to the previous shows of We the People or any of our other programs here on WFYL on our podcast page, 1180wfyl.com.
Right. Thank you, Corinne. Yeah, a little bit of housekeeping there. And, of course, we are now streaming and over the airs as well. And I'm Bruce Stocking along with Corinne Lillis. We're joined by Gary Proctor, who's on the phone, Sam Rohr, and... Gary Porter and Charles Proctor's in studio. And the reason I gave him your name, Chuck, is I want you to kind of comment on the fact of the legal aspect of a mayor, an elected employee, an official, using the city's attorney's office to manipulate and basically lie about numbers just to fit an agenda.
Well, Bruce, as you know, throughout the United States, we often see numbers manipulated, whether it's a petition for something of this nature or a candidate trying to get on the ballot. We've seen this before. What is particularly disturbing here is that there is no authority whatsoever in American jurisprudence for a mayor and a city solicitor to issue a subpoena to a church for one single document. And on top of that, And I don't. Nobody's even commented on this. If they were really interested, they could go to the church on Sunday morning and listen to the sermon.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But to subpoena not only the sermons, but the sermon notes and emails, as I understand it, were all contained in that subpoena. Mm-hmm. It's beyond comprehension.
Yeah, and
I mean, it really smacks of Nazi Germany.
Well, exactly, and that these ministers, these pastors, weren't even involved in the initial lawsuit on there. And, of course, I like what, Gary, you wrote down on here, that some pastors sent the mayor's office copies of the Bible as responding to the subpoena, which I thought was great, and then he started to get Bibles from across the country. That's wonderful. Question is, do they read them? Now, in the Texas Constitution, there are a number of things in their Bill of Rights, and of course, they have no human authority ought in any case whatsoever to control, interfere with the rights and consent of the matter of religion. And Sam, you have some comments on that one.
Well, I do, Gary. You know, in looking at this whole thing now from a pastoral perspective, just at what Chuck said, I think, from my perspective, probably the first time in the history of the country anything of this type has been done here. But these folks evidently did not believe that what they were doing was sufficiently an affront to the Constitution or the rights of our people in order to try to jump into the setting of the church in this fashion. Now, fortunately, people rose up, and there's been a lot of opposition to this, and the mayor has now backed down by pulling the order for those subpoenas. But when I read, Gary, you know, that portion from the Constitution in Texas, which is in most states, ours here in Pennsylvania is very, very clear. It talks down, it talk about the issue of religion. And, you know, this morning I just did something just out of curiosity. I said, you know, let's define that. Because if you were to ask the mayor, my guess is, to define what she thinks religion means, it probably would be a whole lot different than what our founders believed religion meant and what was intended when they put that in the Constitution. So just as a quick comparison here, if you look at the definition of religion from Webster's 1829, which is a dictionary I like to go to because it really was the context more of the meaning of the day, religion in that dictionary says, in the most comprehensive sense, it includes a belief in the being and perfections of God, the revelation of his will to man, man's obligation to obey his commands, a state of reward and punishment, and man's accountability to God, also a godliness of life, piety of life, and so forth. It says, the practice of moral duties without a belief in a divine lawgiver and without reference to his will or commands is not a religion. But if you pull up the same Webster's Dictionary from today, and you read the definition, it just says this. It's a service or worship of God or the supernatural, a personal set or institutionalized system of religious attitudes, beliefs, and practices. And it gives as example, hockey is a religion in Canada. Politics are a religion to him. Where I live, high school football is the religion. Now that's today's that's today's dictionary. And the reason I say these things is because the definitions of words are critical. We are coming at this by saying this was an attack on religion, First Amendment. But if we define it according to today's definition, it's no big deal. But if we define it according to as it was, it's an attack on God himself, which is why we are so concerned, because, in fact, that was the definition of that word in that Texas Constitution as well as ours. So I think in any of these things we look at, it just shows how far we have gone. Mm. So when we talk about something, it's not what the other side is thinking. We got to define our terms.
Yeah, well, of course, Sam, when you mentioned how far we've gone, no matter where you go, you have to have a willingness to sit in that vehicle and go with it, whoever's driving the thing. And complacency on our part, where, as you said, you look at it's not too much of a big deal. Gary, your thoughts on this?
Well, first of all, I really feel bad for Mr. Webster. We have taken his wonderful work and just hacked it to beyond recognition. But anyway, besides that, that shows you one of the problems we have in political dialogue today is that both sides are talking past each other because we no longer have commonly held definitions of some words. And that's why some political dialogue just ends up going nowhere because, you know, we can't find common ground. We have different understanding of words.
Mm-hmm. Well, Chuck, let me ask you this. As an attorney, words mean a lot. Attorneys have always been looked at, they'll take a word and they'll turn it around and make it go the other direction. Is that what's happened to us in this country, that this has taken hold of us?
Well, Bruce, it's very interesting because in class the other day on Tuesday, I have the students during the course of the semester give oral presentations on, and we work our way through the Constitution. And I had a student presenting Article 4, Section 4, and read that section regarding prohibition against or the protection against domestic violence. And all of a sudden I realized that everyone and all of my students were thinking of Ray Rice and someone beating their spouse, not the internal protection of our citizens from internal or external forces. And I had to stop the presentation, get up and say, no, we're not talking about domestic relations here. We're talking about internal protection.
Domestic relations is down the hall.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
So, we have, you know, language has changed and it's something I took for granted. But in that instance, I realized what else is in there that they may have misinterpreted.
Mm-hmm.
And, Corinne, I'm going to throw it over to you for a second. How many times has that come up where something, nomenclature that Bruce or Sam or Gary or myself might take for granted, and in your generation, in your age group, perhaps it's looked at differently just because language has changed, and there's no question about it.
Well, I think that comes up all the time. I think especially because people don't care about language as much in a sense that they're really lazy about it. And we see that with technology. I mean, there's all the abbreviations and stuff like that, but I think it's bigger than that because I don't think people are reading as much. So I think they just don't care about words as much. It's just kind of, I don't know, it's just not something that's important. So I think a lot of things can be misinterpreted because, I don't know, it's not as important in the younger generation eyes. That's just my perspective.
I don't know, gang. It sounds like we're talking a big case of something that the Founding Fathers warned about from the very beginning, and it's called ignorance. We've allowed ourselves to become ignorant, and we become ignorant without knowing it and just, well, that's fine, you know.
Well, I think back in school, I didn't even do as much writing probably, I'm sure, as you guys did. It's a lot more typing and a lot more automatic. You know, if you're typing something, it'll finish the word for you, you know, in the processor and stuff like that. So you're not even really even thinking a lot probably about what you're saying.
Well, I can tell you, back in the day, we used to sit there and write with a dictionary.
It almost tells you, it knows, like, what you're going to say in a sense.
Yeah. Corinne, I've noticed that in my cell phone, when I'm doing a text message, it'll try to finish the sentence for me, which that's not what I want it to do.
Yeah.
But I also can tell when a student did not proofread their paper and they hit spell check, because they'll be close to the spelling. The computer interprets it another way and puts in the wrong word. I can tell every time.
Yeah.
And I say to them, you have to proofread, you have to proofread, you have to proofread. Because it may be fine to get away with that in high school or even college, but when you get to law school, when you get in front of a judge, when you get in front of an appellate court, you can't afford that. And as much as I preach that week after week, I still see them hitting spell check. And also there's a program out there that will take your basic format of your sentence or paragraph and fix it for you.
Yeah, fix it as well.
And I'm not sure even what that's called, Corinne.
Yeah.
You may be more familiar with it. And as a result, of course, all the colleges and universities have come up with a website to check for plagiarism, and they have a huge body of work out there so that we could, if we suspect a paper has been plagiarized, we submit it and it can tell us in 2 seconds if that's been done. But that's the state of what technology has done to students today when they should be doing critical thinking for themselves.
Yeah, well, I don't think a lot of people, too, are going to a dictionary to find out what a word means. Like, if you're reading something and you don't know what a word is, I think a lot of times people just have a tendency to ask a friend or whatever, what does this mean? So it's kind of turned into this own personal interpretation of maybe what a word means instead of getting the exact definition. And then I think, Sam, your example with how the word religion has changed in the dictionary over time, people probably don't even realize that, because how many people open a dictionary to learn what a word means now? People, they're like, oh, I don't have time for that.
Yeah,
you
look at spell check and you go, oh, yeah, that one looks right, you know, and you go with that. Sam, let me ask you this before we go to the break. With pastors, have you found that they fall susceptible at times to the wordsmithing?
Oh, there's no question about that. For instance, in the founders, when they talked about religion, they were talking about the Christian religion, all right? In the new Webster's Dictionary, it gives an example. There are many religions, such as Buddhism, Christianity, Hinduism, Islam, and Judaism. Because, see, the current thought is multi. It's we're one of many. The founders did not perceive. Our moral law system was not a collection of the best of the world. It was Judeo-Christian biblical morality. It's the only way you can produce a constitution and the laws that we have. pastors can slip into that same kind of thing if they believe and they put aside the strict authority of Scripture, which 70% or more of them have. They do not believe that Scripture is totally correct. They think it contains God's Word, but they don't think it is all correct. So they themselves have slipped into this mode, Bruce, where they become the authority on what's true. If any man can come up their own definition of these words or what the Constitution means rather than what it meant, well, it's fair game, open game, which is what I think we're seeing in this administration today. You make it what you want it to be, but that's the result of rejecting absolute truth, and it has happened in many, many pulpits.
Gary, you brought up the 1828 Webster's Dictionary. I think we need to do a push to get it back in the vogue again, make that the new the verbiage and norm, so what's old is new again. You think so?
Yeah, absolutely. And let me just interject something for your readers or your listeners. Today, at the Foundation for American Christian Education, is the last day of a 20% off sale on the Webster's 1828. So if some of your listeners have been sitting on the fence here wondering whether they want to spring for a Webster's 1828, if they call the Foundation for American Christian Education today, they will get one for 20% off.
Sounds like a deal. We're going to take a quick break here on We the People, Constitution Matters. You're listening to 1180 AM WFYL. We'll be right back on the other side of this break.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbone with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFYL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Thanks for sticking with us through the break. You are listening to We the People, Constitution Matters on this Reformation Day. And what a perfect day to talk about our freedom of religion in this country. The threats that are being proposed to it. We spent the first part of the program talking about the situation down in Houston, Texas, where an open lesbian mayor, had subpoenaed sermons from pastors because they were in disagreement about an ordinance known as the bathroom ordinance that was in that town. But there's two others as well I want to get to. And, Gary, you mentioned them in here as well, is the fact in Idaho where we have two ministers, or actually a couple ministers, that are refusing to marry same-sex couples and being threatened with legal aspects. And then there's also an issue in California I want to get to as well before we get to maybe some solutions on what people can do to step up and say enough is enough.
Right. Well, the situation in Idaho apparently has temporarily at least resolved itself. The city finally came out with a determination that the ordinance did not apply to these two pastors who had set up this commercial wedding chapel. So that situation has calmed down for the moment, but it's kind of a hollow victory in the sense that the underlying issue as to whether you can force a minister to perform acts that go beyond their faith our conscience is still, was still not addressed. You know, they retreated on a technicality, so to speak. So that issue is still unresolved in my mind, and I think we'll see it again. I think we'll eventually see, Christian pastors being forced to perform, same-sex marriages in their churches. If the people don't rise up and say, stop this madness, that's where we're going.
Yeah, of course, Thomas Jefferson, in a sense, addressed such things as no man has a natural right to commit aggression on the equal rights of another. And this is all from which the laws ought to restrain him. And, you know, where with Houston, they wanted to pass a law and then manipulate that law. And the mere fact that religion itself is being Christian religion, and I'm going to put it right on that because you don't hear it about Islam or Muslims being treated and attacked such in this country and that. The eroding of the foundation of the structure called the United States to cause the building to collapse. And then, of course, there's California.
Yeah, in California, they passed a law that is going to require Christian organizations, churches, to provide in their health care plans a coverage for surgical abortion.
Yeah.
That is, they're going to force churches to be a party to the physical dismemberment of unborn babies. It's so difficult even to discuss this.
Yeah.
It's so reprehensible.
Yeah, it is.
But that's where California is. And once again, if the people of California, if the people of this country don't rise up and say this is not going to be accepted, if they're going to keep pushing these sorts of initiatives.
Yeah, now, Chuck, this goes right into what you dealt with Hobby Lobby in Conestoga.
Exactly, Bruce. Gary, I was going to say, how in the world can somebody in California even propose this, whether it's legislative or administratively, in light of the Hobby Lobby decision? It flies right in the face of that decision. That's a Supreme Court decision. It's over. It's done. And yet they're still pushing that agenda. And that,
right,
in addition to the absolutely heinous nature of the requirement, I can't even conceive of how they could even propose something. Why waste their time? Which even goes to why they even HHS proposed the mandate to begin with.
Yeah.
Now, right, but will it be successful? Will the Christians in California allow this to happen? That's the question.
Yeah, and that brings us to a point where I want to get to here. And Sam, What can be done? What can start to be done? Because a lot of folks hear this. At times we feel a little bit overwhelmed on all these attacks coming from different directions. Which front do you turn and you take on? But it's going to come down to the people, the Christians, the people of this country.
Bruce, I want to mention something too, because on Tuesday we have Election Day.
Yes.
And there's a big difference between the two, between Tom Corbett and Tom Wolf, with where they stand on life.
Oh,
going back to abortion.
Tom Wolf is a definite abortion supporter.
Right. So this is an opportunity, and it's a spiritual obligation. It's not just an opportunity. For Christians, it's a spiritual obligation to step up, to go out and vote, because if you don't vote, then you're surrendering your right there. And also, if Wolf was enacted into office, then we would be, taxpayer money would go contributing towards abortions.
Well,
by not voting, you're going to be contributing towards it. So,
and also with Wolf in Pennsylvania here, any individual working for the state that has, as Gary put it in his piece here, which I love this term, gender confused individuals, can use state money, your taxpayer money, to get a sex change operation. The morality and good conduct and character, where is it gone? Sam, help us out here.
Well, this is always the big question. We've been identifying now today a lot of where we are, and we always get back to the question of what can we do. All right, part of what we can do is this. what we're trying to do on this program. Education has to be a part of what we're talking about. And wherever that is, on programs like this, we will say, and I say, it's got to begin back in our churches, and that's where the pastors are the lead role. I mean, it happened that way in the beginning of the country. It must happen again. The whole concept of law, what it is, what its purpose for, freedom, liberty, the rule of law, tyranny, all of these things that distinguish what we have and what we're trying to maintain and defend, comes out of moral law, and it comes out of the scripture. And that is the pastor's purpose in order to preach that. If they fail in those areas, then how do the people know? Because you're sure not going to get it in the government school system. So where does it come? It's got to come there, and it's going to be taught in our homes. But there is also a grave in where we're talking here now in this country, where we see so many things sliding, and you have good attorneys like ADF, Chuck sitting right here, and others that are defending. That's critically important because that helps to slow down the attack on where we have. But the rebuilding of the walls doesn't come from just the defending of the law. It comes from the reteaching of the basic principles that underline it. It is the redefining of the terms. It is going back to what we talked about and said, here is what it means. Here is why, when we say freedom, when we say life, when we say unalienable rights, this is what we mean, and take it back to the scripture. We cannot defend, Gary, or hope to get back what we are losing if we as Christians are afraid to stand up and say there is a biblical worldview that has given us what we have. And here are all these other ideologies. Here's the Islamic view that is destructive of it. Here's the organized homosexual view, ideology, that is destructive of it. Here is the Marxist humanist view, which is destructive of it. We have to speak in terms of these things, and those in office have to be speaking in terms of this too, or we will not defend it. You can't. I believe we've gone too far and gone too long in trying to be too sensitive about saying God or sin or evil or tyranny or these kinds of words. Our founders weren't afraid of using them because they were confronted with it. We've got to speak in those kinds of clear terms, I believe, today, or we will just keep beating around the bush while the enemies of freedom just go right to the heart of what we are. God, cut it out. Cut out the Bible. Cut out all of these, the Constitution. You cut these things out enough, we won't have the right. We won't have the freedom. Well, the right. We won't have the freedom to any longer sit as we're doing right here, right now, without somebody shutting down the airwaves. So we've got to be understanding this is very, very critical.
Yeah, that brings up a quote, Bruce, I want to mention from Dr. Lee Vliet. She says, silence in face of evil is itself evil. Not to act is to act. So you think, you know, you're rebelling and you're not, if you just sit back and, you know, you don't want to get involved, but that it's in itself is an evil because it's your obligation to get involved, and you have to, I don't know, we have to wake up.
It also fits into those who complain about a problem but then do not participate in the, even the fact of voting to correct the problem, they are just as much a part of the problem. Now, Sam, when you were talking, a visual came to my mind, and a visual happened to be the Lincoln Memorial. And for those that have been there, as you walk up the stairs into the Lincoln Memorial, into the vast chamber, and see the large statue of Abraham Lincoln seated there, made out of Georgia marble, on each side of the chair, those are reeds bound together to show strength and unity. They're called fascists. In fact, during World War II, the Italians used it. That's where the term fascist came from. But fascists, one reed is easily broken, but many are not. So strength and unity. So this brought to mind with the churches. You don't have the churches, from what I've seen. Sam, you probably have a better view into this than I do, of course. You don't see the churches speaking with one voice. You have some that are very weak, the pastors are very weak, and the congregation sits there and does nothing to say, hey, listen, you know, I look at them in a sense just like our representatives, either step up to the plate or we'll find somebody else that will. But to get that unity in the churches going again, because churches of the Christian faith should all speak with one voice, unified. Am I right?
Well, no, they should. That's exactly correct. And, one of the things that the American Pastors Network is attempting to do, and it's really beginning to expand very greatly, is the fact that when you have a vehicle, which what we're, one of the things we're trying to do is a vehicle by which pastors who believe in authority, Scripture, and believe these things we're talking about, can actually speak with a unified voice. Many are afraid. Put it bluntly, many pastors are afraid to speak outside the walls of their church in a clear fashion. They don't know how to speak to the media, and they're afraid of that. They can speak in their own congregation, but many of them don't even do that there. But for those, but when they know that there are others who are doing it, we're hearing it across the country. Oh, we are so glad to know about this. We will be glad to be a part of it. We'll be glad to stand with somebody else. We're afraid to stand by ourselves. That's right. That's human nature.
Sure.
That's human nature.
Sure.
But this is happening. And I do believe, bringing it back to this whole situation in Houston, you know, sometimes we have to be jolted awake. And at this point, what has happened in Houston has really rallied a lot of people and wakened many in the pulpit who were very casual about even their preaching, saying, wait a minute. If that can happen in Houston, which is what we're saying, if it can happen in Houston, it can happen here in Pennsylvania, any other state. And so, therefore, any person, whether you are committed to Scripture or not, if you like what you're doing in the pulpit and be able to say it clearly, you'd better stand up and join in this opposition here, mm-hmm. or the whole concept of religious freedom and speaking clearly without being audited by the government,
right.
Is going to be lost. So there is strength in unity. And there's no question about it. And those who are listening need to know that there. I mean, that there. When that happens, people like the mayor down there do hear it. That's
yeah.
why the mayor rescinded what she did. That's
yeah.
why the Idaho circumstance did. But as Chuck said, or Gary said, it's going to come around. This victory has not been won. This war has not been won. These
right.
little skirmishes are being controlled right now. But believe you me. This is a war that's going on, and we had better anticipate that and gird ourselves for the long fight because
yeah.
it's here.
Hey, Sam?
Gary.
Sam, there's one more thing I think the churches should address, and they've been reticent to do that, but it really needs to be addressed, and that's the 501c3 status thing. Pastors who have incorporated their churches as 501c3s are now under the thumb of the government. I mean, they have made that entanglement, and they now have to abide by these IRS regulations. Now, granted, if you really are familiar with these IRS regulations, they give the church just great latitude. There's only a couple of things they can't say from the pulpit, but nevertheless, it's an intimidating factor. And I think the churches really need to address whether this 501c3 status that most of them have put themselves under is necessary to their success and survival as a church. Because the churches who have chosen not to go that route are under no compulsion whatsoever as to what they can say and cannot say from the pulpit, and that gives the pastors the complete freedom that they should have under God's rule to speak their minds.
Yeah. Now, Chuck, I think we talked before about churches do not need to be 501c3.
No, that they don't. They automatically have it. Number one. Number two, the pastors have confused the issue here. They can speak out on a subject. What they can't do is endorse a candidate. They can invite both candidates into church and have them both present. If one doesn't show up, they can still have the other one present.
Mm-hmm.
People don't realize that. They can speak on an issue. But they're confusing this amendment, which was passed by Lyndon Johnson in the middle of the night back in the 50s, because he's running for re-election and his opponent was gaining some traction in the churches, and he passed this in trying to silence them, and pastors have been running scared ever since. In addition, similar to Sam's Speak Up initiative that he's put together for the churches, ADF has one similarly that was last month. And starting just a few years ago, we had maybe a half a dozen or a dozen churches that taped their sermons and sent them to the IRS. looking, almost looking, saying, hey, if you have a problem with this, let's go. We now are over 2,000 churches doing this annually, Bruce, every year, and I expect it to double each year, and we're prepared. If the IRS were going to try to come in and take away someone's tax-exempt status, they would lose. All the research has been done. All the briefs have been written. We're just ready to have a plaintiff to go to court with.
But, of course, with the IRS, they're back in the news again doing their target thing. And, of course, as this president said, there's not a smidgen of truth of corruption in the IRS. And I think what has happened, you almost would think, was organized to give the IRS the, let's use the term, the bully status to keep people under their thumb, to keep them oppressed.
Exactly, and without giving them the right information. And we go around, Pennsylvania Family Institute, Randy Wenger and myself, we go around the state and we talk to pastors, we talk to different groups about IRS regulations and what they can or cannot do under the current regulations, and encouraging them to stand up. And we also help them separate in the IRS from local property tax issues, which is another one that's come up lately. And we've had several instances where I've had to get involved where local municipalities are trying to tax faith-based activities in a church just because they occur during the weekday. For example, daycare centers. Now, if you rent out your church to a secular daycare, that's one thing. But when you, the church, run a faith-based daycare or a Christian school of any sort, and it's your teachers with your faith, and of course you have to charge something for your to maintain the property and keep the lights on, what have you, that's fine. But the municipalities don't understand that, and as a result they're trying to remove tax exempt status from the properties. So what do pastors do? Oh, we don't dare do anything other than maybe a bake sale once a month for the ladies' auxiliary. And that's just wrong.
That's ignorance.
Wrong. Yeah, and we're seeing it more and more. And I know the municipalities are desperate for money. I realize that the finances are difficult, but they can't make it up on the backs of the churches.
Yeah, exactly. And Gary, you wrote about that as well, about the taxation of the churches that some people think it's good. You want to elaborate a little on that?
I'm not sure which essay you're referring to.
The same one where we talked about the churches here. It says, the fact that approval of sermons by the government officials and perhaps a removal of church tax exemption. Some would find this actually a good thing.
Well, yes, that's what I was alluding to, to get the churches out from under this 501c3, because it has been misconstrued and misinterpreted. The best thing that I would see would be to just abandon it altogether. Now, the churches think they're going to lose their contributions by doing this, that people will think they no longer have the ability to take a tax deduction, and then their financial base will dry up. But if Christians need a tax deduction in order to contribute to their church's health, then there's a fundamental problem there that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, that's, of course, a lot of things people are looking at. Again, we're falling right to the IRS again, going with tax deduction on that. But, and also, Sam, you've got a lot of people themselves who went to church for years but are just simply drifting away from those churches for whatever reason here. And that's got to affect what's going on.
Well, it does, but excuse me, so much of that drift, I mean, clearly, if people generally don't want knowledge, because knowledge obligates you. So there is a certain element, I've always said, that ignorance is bliss. I've said many in office are this way, many in the pulpit, many in the pews. If you know something, then you develop some obligation to deal with the effects of what you learn. So if you're lazy, you just don't want to learn, right? Mm-hmm. So there are many in the pews who don't want to be disturbed. They want to be kept comfortable in their activities. Well, that's a problem. If the pastor, though, complies with it and allows them to stay comfortable in their activities, sinful activities or whatever, then the pastor has now doubled down and actually contributed to that problem. There is no substitute for telling of the truth, living the truth, standing up for the truth. That's what this program is all about. This is the truth. The Constitution is the truth of our civil law. Underneath of that civil law truth is moral truth. Those two go together. We walk away from truth at our own peril. And I think what it comes down to, I mean, truth does cause a reaction. You either accept it or you reject it. All of what we're talking about here, all of those that are opposed to the Constitution, trying to undercut it, the mayor in Houston, what are they doing? Rejecting moral and civil truth.
Yeah.
And what are we trying to do? Defend it. So it all comes down to a matter of truth. And if the pastor believes for a moment that their obligation is to keep people comfortable, which unfortunately, Gary, is the majority by surveys. The majority of pastors in the pulpit are more concerned about having their people leave feeling comfortable. Mm-hmm. This is what has to change, but obviously staying to the truth, fearing God more than man, focuses down on it, and that produces the change. We have to tell the truth, and we have to abide by it, and then things change.
Yeah, because that changes the way the pastors used to be, because they used to be provocative and get people to think, and you know, you heard about back in the Victorian age, the old fire and brimstone type of thing. Perhaps we need to get back to that, to wake people up.
Bruce, I've actually seen pastors who have said from the pulpit, I'm not going to discuss politics, I'm not going to discuss current events, I'm not going to discuss these issues that are important to our country from the pulpit. We're going to talk about the nice things. And I've heard them say that. Now, what message does that convey to the congregation? Well, that's not only, well, go home and feel good, but it's also, well, you don't need to vote either. Yeah, which is what we talked about at the beginning of the program today.
Yeah, so you make it sound like you go for an hour, put a offering in the plate, that's your cover charge for the show, and then you leave. That's what it sounds like.
Exactly.
Gary, I'll give you the last word.
Well, I'd like to leave the last word up to Sam Adams, because as we face next Tuesday, here's what Sam Adams said about voting in 1781. Let each citizen remember, at the moment he is offering his vote, that he is not making a present or a compliment to please an individual, or at least that he ought not to do so, but that he is executing one of the most solemn trusts in human society, for which he is accountable to God and his country. So when Christians go to the polls next Tuesday, they need to go so in a prayerful attitude, having already discussed this vote that they're about to give with God, and really thought out what they're about to do, because it is the most solemn trust that we give to them in our society.
Well spoken. Well spoken. That brings us to another end here on We the People Constitution Matters for this week. I want to remind everybody that on Sunday, it's turn your clocks back. It's daylight savings time. And if you're going out with the kids tonight trick-or-treating, be safe out there. Be careful. But do something with the youngsters, because they're only young once. And just enjoy the day. And we'll see you next week here on We the People Constitution Matters, right here on 1180 AM WFYL. Have a good weekend.